Hey, it's Jay, and today I get to do something that always makes me cackle. I that's the best word, guffaw. What? It's like awkward, loud, just massive laugh alone in my office, enough to scare my dog awake. And that thing I get to do today is share with you a brand new thing that I've been working on for a while, a thing I deeply care about and have wanted to make for a long time. It's the trailer for my upcoming new podcast, How Stories Happen. You can follow How Stories Happen anywhere you get podcasts, and we'll be doing a lot of videos that spin out of the show and also help you witness the show later in the show's run. But for now, I wanted to play the trailer for you right here and invite you to visit howstorieshappen.com to learn more about the show and find the links to follow the show where you like to listen. But first, I think you deserve to know, if you listen to this show, what about Unthinkable? In short, Unthinkable will no longer release new episodes. I've been running the show since 2016, and a friend asked me recently, why are you moving on? Is it the audience isn't growing? Does the new show tie to your business a little bit better? That part is true. And yeah, there's some strategic decisions I could be making, but really it's an emotional one. I have more inside me that I want to get out into the world. I have more to give and more to say and new and different things to try. And just like the actor who leaves a show or the comedian who sets aside the proven act, it's time for the next big swing and the next meaningful project for me. So that's the real reason I'm moving on. And yes, the new show does connect to my consulting and the membership that I run, the Creator Kitchen, a little bit more fully. So I'd invite you to follow How Stories Happen wherever you listen to podcasts. I will be running some of the early episodes right here in the Unthinkable feed. And obviously today you're going to hear the trailer. Or you can subscribe to my free newsletter at jayaconzo.com. But a little backstory I think is worthwhile here. Because if you've been listening to this show, even just for a little moment in time, I think you deserve as much. Unthinkable began in 2016 with one stated purpose. And I quickly realized it was something else entirely. And then it became a third thing. And that took us all the way from 2016 through today in spring of 2024 when I'm recording this. But in 2015, I decided to launch a blog called Sorry for Marketing because I felt sorry about some of the marketing my previous employers had tasked me with doing, and I felt sorry for the marketing industry at large that seemed stuck with this culture of settling. So I decided to attack an enemy through my work, average content. I'd spent years working on marketing teams at brands big and small, ranging from Google and HubSpot to a tiny startup that no one's heard of and a venture capital firm. After all of that, I emerged pretty disillusioned with the entire field of marketing. I was ashamed at how much mediocrity I'd shipped personally and even more frustrated with the mentality that seemed to surround me and felt endemic to the industry. After writing about my hatred for average content a few times, I decided to launch a podcast and I called it Unthinkable. The name was a hint towards what I had said in a moment of pure frustration to a friend of mine, business speaker extraordinaire, Andrew Davis. I said something like, here's a novel idea. Instead of everybody creating endless mediocre junk, why not create like genuinely good things? Wouldn't those things then be easier to market? Isn't it easier to get a well-built rocket into orbit? So why do we keep taping together scrap metal and trying to yeet it into the sun? It's called content marketing, not marketing content. Which comes first? The content. So here's a wild concept. Instead of pushing harder to generate subscribers, why not make things worth subscribing to? Instead of obsessing over growing followers, do something worth following. I am so tired of saying to people in the marketing world, hey, you know that thing you're making? Yeah, you should make it, I don't know, good? What a shocker. What a crazy idea. And as I kind of like panted and sweated after that rant, Drew looked at me and he goes, you should call the show Unthinkable. Perfect. I knew the enemy of the story that I wanted to tell the world. Average content was the enemy. That was the illness in our industry. Of that, I was certain. But I was wrong. Because then I began to interview you, my listeners. Every month for the first 12 months of making this show, I had 5 calls with listeners and email subscribers. Every call was 30 minutes. I'd spend the first 15 asking you questions about your work and your problems, rarely asking about my show or relationship to me. And then we could use the second half of the call however would be useful or interesting to you. Those calls changed the entire trajectory of not just my show, but my career. I don't think that's hyperbole. It showed me that I had not identified the actual illness I was here to cure, despite my assumption and despite my initial potential diagnosis that the core problem was average content. Because my listeners were, sure, some marketers, sure, some solo independent creators. But there were also a lot of accountants and tech startup CTOs and consultants and independent coaches, people who might have created some content or no content, but they seemed to like the message of the show. And I found out it was because they all loved being creative in some sense in their work. They loved the idea of craft and quality, and they hated the stale norms of their industries. Hearing a bunch of professionals talk on the show about unconventional choices and care for craft, that was really refreshing to them. So it turns out I found a symptom of an illness, average content, but not the illness itself. What caused average content? Best practices. My audience and I both despise this idea of best practices at work. We always questioned them, rejected them, saw them for what they really were, average practices, generalized advice. My audience saw the obsession with best practices gripping those around them, their clients, their current or former employers, their peers. They believed, and I believe too, that the over-reliance on conventional wisdom or trendy new things was the barrier to doing exceptional work, because we were always looking for blueprints. We were always looking for the generalized right approach. And so I diagnosed that as best practices. I remember I posted once across my social media, I wish there was a Chrome browser extension that changes the word best in best practices to average. And people liked that. More importantly, I did too. I could see myself making a living helping people question or even break from best practices. Now that would be unthinkable. I had no cure for this problem, at least not yet, but I thought I'd found the illness. It felt more certain this time than average content as the enemy I should attack. So my creative platform shifted again to talk about the problems with best practices and explore why they're so popular, why they're so problematic, and what happens when we follow them versus break from them, and who is successfully building in their own unique and unconventional way. I'd found the illness. Of that, I was certain. But once again, I was wrong. I kept writing and speaking about that same issue, and then I realized, wait, there's something even more foundational under best practices. Best practices are still a symptom. What was the illness? I didn't know yet. I sensed it, but I couldn't say it. And then one day, as I wrote about the usual topics, this following line flowed from my fingertips onto the page. Finding best practices isn't the goal. Finding the best approach for you is. Okay, wait, I thought. There's something in there. Is this what I've been missing? Finding best practices isn't the goal. Finding the best approach for you is. Why don't we start with the for you, for us, for me piece of this? Why do most of us begin our work by turning outward, not inward, seeking the right answers? Why do we assume that best practices are, in fact, the best, when really they can't consider the specifics of our unique situations? I mean, just the fact that we are present in the work means that we're introducing new variables that some expert did not anticipate. We treat best practices like precise math problems, but without considering the variables that are unique to us, we're just running faulty equations. So why do we do that? The answer? School. Now, to be clear, school did not become the enemy I attacked, but something about our schooling and our early attempts at building businesses or joining companies led us to this point. The corporate world would perpetuate what went on in school. So let me go back to school and think here. In school, you're handed right answers. You're told, sit in lines, don't be weird, don't make mistakes, otherwise you'll get your test back bleeding red ink. Don't share a response to the question they ask unless you're absolutely, totally, 100% certain it is the right answer, because having the right answer is the point of school. Having the right answer is the point of you. That is the illness. That is the foundational problem. We are deathly afraid of being wrong, so we seek the right answer. Hell, we can't operate without it. That's the actual illness. I called it the tyranny of the right answer. So I started writing and podcasting and speaking some more. This show evolved to attack the tyranny of the right answer, and to encourage people to think for themselves, trust their intuition, break from best practices, and use the variables right in front of their faces every day. Because from a young age, that is made nearly impossible for most of us. Our self-worth becomes bottled up in this idea that being smart and valuable and successful means you already know the answers. If you don't know, don't speak up. Don't raise your hand to find out. Don't make a mess to try stuff. Don't investigate, and definitely don't do it your way. This is why so many people in my ecosystem who do create content lament the fact that they have writer's block, that they have imposter syndrome, that they can't create because they're not good enough yet. The mess is where you find your best. People aren't willing to make a mess. People aren't willing to create without having the answer, the pristine playbook, the best practices. But I think instead of gathering up all the answers you think you need to justify creating, you should create to find your answers. But you won't living in the tyranny of the right answer. In that world, self-awareness doesn't matter. Uniqueness is terrible. Awareness of the correct response is the entire game. The Industrial Revolution spawned this public education system that we now have, which is struggling to evolve to our modern world, and it's meant to create compliant workers and factories and industrialized farms. Any notion of exploring or expressing or innovating wasn't ever part of the plan. So why be surprised when blueprints supersede intuition in our collective consciousness? You are worthy when you have the right answer. That's what we're told. You are worthless if you don't. We live in this tyranny of the right answer, and that is the illness. I rode that train of thought for quite a while. It informed how I introduced the concept of this show, the premise, every single episode. It informed how I evolved the branding of the show, the cover art. It informed the stories that I told and then used in my speeches, in my books, in my guest appearances, in my writing. Once I found the illness to diagnose and cure somewhere between 2016 and 2017, it felt like I could draw a coherent circle around my work. Everything I saw in the world became material, and everything I did felt focused and more powerful. That's one major benefit of finding your premise and developing better stories pressed through that lens. What I learned was that we should be developing a defensible premise, some kind of assertion that we make about what should be for the audience we want to serve, for the industry that we occupy. That defensible assertion, that premise, is shaped by your perspective. It informs your stories and makes them more effective. It helps you differentiate and resonate, not through hollow stunts and gimmicks to grab attention, but through the substance that you offer, and then, of course, the stories that you tell. It's an ability. It's a craft. And it's within our control. So we face a choice. We can continue trying to ship more volume into the world, or we can learn to compete on the impact of our ideas. The impact of an idea is directly related to two things: how valuable it is to others and how original it is to you. When you develop an idea from a concept in your brain to actual content, some kind of story that others can experience, that process is rarely put on display. And that brings us to my new show. How Stories Happen is dedicated to this idea of helping you compete on the impact of your ideas, not the volume of your work, and it centers on the thing that I know you and I love. Because regardless of the topics that were featured on these episodes here in Unthinkable, regardless of the guests or the style of edits, I think you and I always shared a love of stories. But more than that, we shared that love because we wanted to be effective storytellers ourselves. We are the freaks, maybe? I don't know. We're the professionals, at least, who look at great stories and storytellers and go, wow, I want to do that. But there's a very big difference between learning story and being storytellers. My new show, How Stories Happen, puts that on display with a new format for its episodes that we don't often see in the business world, dedicated to that shift. And with that, I want to thank you for listening to Unthinkable, the show that changed my career and my life. And with How Stories Happen, I hope to change yours. Reminder to please follow How Stories Happen wherever you get your shows. And now, the trailer for that show. Please enjoy. Check, check. Voiceover, How Stories Happen trailer. What does it take
to resonate, to write and speak and create with greater impact. These are not ideas we explore deeply enough in the business world today. I mean, spend any time on the internet and you get so much advice from people in business about competing on the volume of your content, not the impact of your ideas. Mostly, when you look to build a brand or grow an audience for yourself, you're met by all kinds of advice that, if you're anything like me, just isn't cutting it. The hacks, the cheats, the shortcuts, the algorithm gaming, the lazy uses of AI, all the apps that promise to instantly 10x your content in 10 seconds, and all the services saying they'll take one big piece of content and repurpose them into dozens, hundreds of pieces, unlimited repurposing power. Not unlimited communication power, just unlimited stuff. It has never been easier to create mediocrity at scale. But some of us refuse.
Well, I sort of feel like you've got to have signature stories and signature bits to even be an interesting person.
It's a story that has become sort of like mythology in my own mind.
Maybe I just crossed a line. Maybe I'm going to get fired. I don't know. It was stressful.
And somebody says, so tell me about the moment you decided to leave Google. And I go, all right, here we go again.
The nice thing about having a back pocket story like this is
a moment of connection with the audience. In a way, I want them to feel seen.
You can control your standards. You can control what you aim to do. And in doing that, you can create better results.
It doesn't matter if you're in a conference room or you're waiting in line at the DMV or you're at Applebee's or you're on Hinge or, I mean, like, you know, everything that you want in life will have a better chance of being accrued by you if you can actually communicate with powerful and interesting stories.
I'm Jay Akunzo. I'm an author, speaker, a show host, and a consultant to experts and entrepreneurs, helping them stand out through substance and stories, not hollow stunts. Over 2 decades of creating stuff online across every conceivable medium or type of project, my belief in a single idea has only grown stronger. We should prioritize resonance over reach. This is about making things that matter to our careers, companies, and communities. And it turns out when you matter more, you need to hustle for attention less. That's why people like you and me believe so strongly in the power of storytelling. But I've also realized, despite all the information out there about storytelling, there's still a really big difference between learning story and being a storyteller. Storytelling is a craft. Differentiating and resonating are skills you can learn. But if you look around and try to learn that stuff, it's always so oversimplified or overpromised. We get general advice or supposed secrets from gurus, or we get a bunch of basic techniques, structures, and tips. But if storytelling is a craft, then to learn it, shouldn't we try to get closer to, like, the actual crafting? That's what this show aims to do. Every episode, an expert, an entrepreneur, or a world-class communicator breaks apart one story or draft piece by piece. They'll share how they found it, how they developed it, and how it might improve, as well as how they're using it to build their career, their company, and their community.
And I liked how it felt, and it felt like it was good for the service of the story, it was good for performance, so I brought that factoid in, whereas it wasn't part of my original first draft.
The power of the story is to let the quote speak for itself. And I think the reason why it works is because it's somewhat subversive.
And in 1993, we sold Budweiser.com for 50 cases of beer.
The biggest thing that did for us was signal to the industry at large that we were a team to be taken seriously and that we created quality work.
The longer you hold that beat, and I like to hold it long enough where people start to think, did he forget the line, right? Where they're not sure, like it's just slightly awkward.
It allows for space for the audience in their minds to be like, well, did he say this? Did he say this? What could he have said?
And then deliver the line. It works every time.
Yeah, you have all these techniques and structures and tools and general advice that you can access in an instant. But all of that stuff really describes the process.
I worried that the third one would sound more self-serving or self-centric, that people wouldn't see themselves in it.
Other people are messy and confusing and irrational. And you too are messy and confusing and irrational.
We need to master the whole of it The craft itself is three different things, and process is just one. There's also the posture and the practice.
You know, storytelling is a performance.
My family would call me the drama of the family, but not because I was creating the drama, because I was recreating the drama.
I'm always trying to James Bond it. In a James Bond movie, there's never a long explanation about how James Bond happens to be in Tuscany. You're in Tuscany and James Bond is in a car and going really fast and you're like, and he's beating the hell out of somebody and they're beating the hell out of him and the car's just gone off a cliff and you're like, oh my God, I'm 45 seconds in and I'm like having a heart attack because of the adrenaline.
I think it kind of like blossomed from what details are necessary and then what points could I dramatize? Could I perform more?
Understanding that your job is to entertain.
This stuff all unfolds in the minutiae with all these hidden choices, choices that we're trying to bring out into the light. We're going to talk to our guests not about their general advice, but about the actual making of something that moves people. Any advice that emerges will be stronger because of that.
Yeah, that was to say it out loud. I am thinking about connecting those hooks with the meat of the story.
I went back and I found my notes from those days. I found the papers that I'm talking about that had my notes from the meeting. I found journal entries from that same time period where I was recapping my feelings from the day.
I could weave in more how I felt in that moment because the story is the morning walk. And then what I'm making that mean about how we approach our work and our businesses.
But I agree with you. I think there's a way that that could be, you know, pacier and faster. And
Yeah. Because the real nugget there is, I just quit what I thought was my worst working relationship ever. Turns out it was actually the next one.
That is great. I'm going to just take that line straight away.
Together, we'll bridge the gap between learning story and being a storyteller.
I think the same thing is true with business storytelling. They say, well, it has to be a story about business. No, it doesn't. It has to be a story about this industry. No, it doesn't. It has to be a story that happened to me. No, it doesn't.
That I think sometimes pushes us to forget to include the details that make us human or the details that make our stories truly relatable on this level of like, oh, I used to feel that way or like I see myself in that.
Here's what it needs to be. A story that the people who are listening can understand and benefit from. Full stop.
That's the difference between creating even more commodity content and creating things that actually matter. Things that are more valuable to others and more original to us. This is not about reach. This is about resonance. It's about making things that matter because when your work matters more, you can hustle for attention less.
Is it a learned skill? Yeah, at some level.
The speakers and storytellers that seem the most natural and open in the moment are the ones that are actually the most rehearsed.
You can learn it, right? You can get better at it.
As Ira Glass said, great stories happen to those who can tell them. He's not saying stories only appear to people who are already masters of the craft. He's saying it is a craft. Stories don't happen to you, life happens to you. And then you put your butt in the chair and turn that into stories. Storytellers don't have to experience anything extraordinary when they know how to imbue meaning into things that are ordinary. It's the active work between idea and content that makes something a story. And when we do that active work, we can rely on our posture, our process, and our practice, our craft. We're putting that craft front and center every episode of this show.
Almost everything that happens to you every day is potentially a story. You just have to give yourself permission to tell it.
Because that is how stories happen.
Shoot. As soon as I said yes to this, I thought, why did I say yes to workshop a story with the master of storytelling? I'm being a total wuss. Okay. Don't judge me, listeners. Okay.